The Ear, Evangelical and Reformed, Christian Podcast. Welcome to The Ear, the Evangelical and Reformed, a Christian podcast that urges you to think deeper and draws you closer to God through faith. Through powerful sermons, teaching segments, and discussions, The Ear hopes to give you a different perspective on secular topics from a Christian worldview. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Please welcome your host, Brandon Queen.
We have to face our mistakes and live with them because that's what really causes us to change.
So what does the Bible really say about credit and loans? What is the point of credit score? What does having a high credit score really say about you? Can I live debt-free with no credit cards or loans? Do I really need the stuff that I buy on credit?
Don't sleep, don't give your eyes any rest, work your butt off, and get out of debt like the gazelle gets away from the hunter.
We as Christians are taught to be frugal with our resources and live within our means. On last week's episode, we discussed why in this culture we say we need credit and why do we buy into the trap. Brennan asked this question.
The only way to have a good credit score is by making your payments on time. That's the only way. You borrow money, you borrow things, and you make all your payments on time. When someone tells me they have a good credit score, you want to know my response?
Yeah, man. Tell me what your response is.
Okay. So what I say is, I'm so sorry. And the reason is because, you know, like what I was just saying, that the only way to have a good credit score is by continually making your payments and being stuck in the land of payments. That's my response. What, I have an 850 credit score. Oh, I'm so sorry. They're like, what? What do you mean? And you're sorry. Well, you know, all that means is you borrow a lot and you way overspend and you probably have nothing.
Yeah, see, and that makes a lot of sense too. Having, like, I'm not gonna lie to you. I wish my credit score was an 850, but then you're gonna tell me I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, because all it means is that you borrow a bunch of stuff and you pay for it on time. Like that's the only way to get there. And so we have to get to this point of understanding borrowing is not how we get stuff. It works. You can get stuff when you do that, but you're only doing it that way because you don't actually have the money to get it yourself.
Right.
And in the long term, if you look forward further than just, you know, next month's payment, it's really setting you up for so much failure and it's stealing away your income month after month after month. And it's never allowing you to build any kind of retirement or anything. There's some math that I do for people. If you were to take the average car payment in America today is $500, 500 and some change, I can't remember. If you were to take that 500 and just simply invest it into a good growth stock mutual fund, like in a Roth IRA, in a mutual fund that's outperforming the market, you would retire with over, if you were to do that from, let's say, age 25 to age 65, a normal working lifetime, you would retire with over $3 million. But instead, what we do is when we're 25 years old, we go and get a car with a payment. We pay for it until it's paid off. And then once it's paid off, it's also old and it's lost a lot of its value and it's starting to break down. So what do? We trade it in and we get another payment. And so we keep car payments most of our working lifetime. A lot of us take car payments to the grave. And instead of building up a retirement, we spend all that money on cars. And a lot of people, you know, they'll say, oh, well, yeah, I'm just going to get this one car on payments. I'm going to pay it off and then I'm going to keep it forever. And we all say that and we all want to believe that. But almost never does that happen. Instead, we just go and get another new car with payments and we continue this cycle of being broke and all of our income being stolen away by stuff.
Yeah, I'm in that cycle right now where my car is 2 years out from being paid off, but I put a plan in place to where I'll have it paid off hopefully in the next 10 months. Mm-hmm. And it's like, huh, I can keep this car.
Yeah.
Now, I want a truck. Do I need a truck? Probably. But no, I don't need a truck. I want a truck because trucks are very nice. Yeah. I am a truck fanatic. But I bought myself a Hyundai Elantra back in 2016 because I traveled a lot and it's great on gas.
Yeah.
It is not the fancy name brand car, but that little sucker gets me from point A to point B. I've had the car for about close to 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And I'm just getting up to like the 42,000 mile mark on it. And I'm just having to change my tires.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, if I don't get another car and this car can last me another 10 to 12 years, if I keep it up and fix the things that break, I'm going to save $335 a month.
That's right.
That's how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. So there's a method to getting nicer, newer vehicles. So what we teach people is, I mean, in most cases, the vehicle is the largest expense, the largest thing that we purchase in this country beside the house. So first, the first biggest expense is the house. The next one is the car, the vehicle. So what we teach is, since your car payments are killing you, you know, most houses have two car payments, but since they're just completely taking away all your money to the tune of $600 or even $1,000 a month, you know, two car payments at $400 each is $800 a month. So what we teach is get rid of those cars. Even if you're upside down, there's a way to sell them and get out of them. And you've got to start driving a car that is mechanically reliable and safe. But you're not looking for anything flashy. You're not looking for low mileage. You're not looking for any of that stuff. And it comes back to short-term sacrifice for long-term gain. So if you'll drive a car that's a little bit more of a beater for, let's just say, a year, okay, and that car costs you a total of $3,000, that car has already lost almost all of its value. So in the next year, you can probably sell it for almost the same price that you bought it at. So if you bought it at $3,000, let's say you can sell it at $2,500 in the next year. In the meantime, you have no car payments. So if your payment was $350, instead, now you're saving that $350 every month. So if you multiply that by 12, you're saving that $350 for a year. Every month for a year. That's $4,200 plus the sale of your car at $2,500. Now you've got $6,700 to move up in vehicle. Okay, so now you go get yourself a $6,000 vehicle and you repeat the process. For the next year, you save that $350 a month that you would have been spending on a car payment. And then you sell your vehicle. It hasn't lost a lot of value. So now you sell a $6,000 vehicle for, let's say, $5,000, plus you've saved your $4,000. Now you're getting yourself a $9,000 or a $10,000 vehicle. So within a few years, you can get yourself a really nice vehicle, whether it's a truck, car, whatever. But again, you're not spending a ridiculous amount of interest. You're being a lot more wise with this money, and no one is coming to take your vehicle away if some kind of crisis comes up in your life. Because when you've got this car payment, and if anything, any bump in the road happens, you know, the road of your life, you have to somehow figure out how to keep up with that payment. And if you can't do it, they come and take the car away. Whereas if you own the car, that doesn't happen. Again, no payments means options.
Yeah. See, when I actually bought my car, I did something smart because I sold my old car and I sold it for $1,200 because I needed to get rid of it. And instead of taking that $1,200 and either sticking it into a savings account or, you know, just keeping it to spend and have extra money
blowing
on
it.
I took that $1,200 and I literally stuck it on the principal for the new car.
Yeah.
And when my friend asked me, what happened to the money you did when you sold your car? Oh, I put it on my new car. Why would you do that? Because I want to get out of debt.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but a lot of people, they see extra money and say, oh, I could go buy this. Oh, I could go buy this gun. No, let's save that.
Plan. That's right. When you have your plan, you have your budget, you get that extra money and you say, oh, here's what I really need to do with this money. But when you don't have that plan, when you don't have your budget, you get extra money and you say, here's what I want to do with this money. And so you go and do that.
Right. I mean, and the next question was, you know, why do people have credit cards? We kind of answered that question. Mm-hmm. You know, people are lazy and don't want to work, you know, the extra mile, if you will, to get what they need, keyword need.
Right.
So they go out and they take a loan.
Yeah.
All of us are guilty of it. You know, I probably could have made my old car work for another 5 to 6 years.
Right. And imagine if you had done that and saved what you're paying for your car now for those 5 years. Right. I mean, you know, that's $4,000 a year for 5 years that you could have had by this time, a $20,000 vehicle that you paid cash for.
Yeah, you're right.
Get yourself a really nice truck with that money.
Don't rub it in my face, Brennan.
Hey man, we have to face our mistakes and live with them because that's what really causes us to change, you know? But the credit thing, we have this idea that, you know, when we can't make ends meet, instead of dropping our lifestyle, we go and borrow to make ends meet.
Right.
And so we build this life of having so many payments and having so much expenses that we don't make enough money to sustain it all. So we've got to go and get a credit card for our groceries and for, you know, the vacation that we want to take and just all this stuff. And also, like I was saying, we just naturally spend more when we use that plastic. And all of these companies, all of these credit card companies know that, and they bank on that. That, you know, there may be a few people who are paying off their balance every month and not getting charged interest or whatever. And that's, you know, great. I guess I'm kind of happy for you. But if you're paying off your balance every month and you're never owing any money on your credit card, why are you even?
You don't need it.
Yeah, you don't need it. And when I say, well, why are you using it? People will throw something at me like, well, I get 1% cash back or whatever it is. Let's think about this. Okay, let's analyze this. 1% cash back. You have to spend $100,000 in a year to get $1,000 back. How does this make sense? You're overspending to the tune of like $50,000, right? Because your household expenses, if you're anything like my family, a toddler, a baby on the way, marriage, you know, all this stuff, your expenses should be somewhere around $50,000. Obviously, if you live in like New York or California or some of these more expensive states, that's going to be different, as well as your income is going to be different. But on average, your expenses should be somewhere around $50,000. So if you're spending $100,000 on a credit card so that you can get $1,000 back, you're overspending to the tune of $50,000. I'd rather not spend that extra $50,000. You see, there's so many tricks and tactics that these companies use to get you to use their product. And again, because we don't think it through, we don't think long-term, we don't pay attention, it works. Credit cards, debt is not a system that is meant to help you, the consumer. It's a system that's meant to help the lender. That's why their buildings are bigger than yours. That's why their furniture's nicer than yours. Their houses are nicer than yours. That's why, because it's a system that works for them, and that's how they make their money.
I call that modern day slavery.
Yeah. These may not be evil people, but I mean, this is their business model and they take it very seriously. And we get pumped all of these advertisements and we go and consume. And so we really have to pay attention to that.
Absolutely. And I wish more people would.
Yeah.
So now my next question is kind of a detrimental question. What should one do if they are in desperate need of a loan to pay their bills?
There is almost no circumstance that this is the case. I've worked with so many people, many of them being people who struggle, who, you know, about one in every 10 people or couples that I help has an income issue, meaning their income is just too low. They're below the poverty line. In every other case, there's no income issue. The problem is they have no plan. They have no idea what their money's doing, and they have too many payments, and they've got to start getting rid of some stuff and being more responsible. So there's almost zero circumstance that someone needs to get a loan to pay their bills. In fact, what they need to do is pay closer attention to their budget, get a more strict plan in place, and then also what we were talking about at the beginning, work harder, be more diligent, and be more valuable to the marketplace. Because it's not – if you've got to borrow to pay bills, one, you either have too many bills, or two, you don't have enough income, okay? or three, what I was just saying, you have zero plan and you just think you need to borrow to pay bills. That should never, almost never be the case. There's been a lot of people that have come to me that have thought, you know, should I file bankruptcy? The answer is almost always absolutely not. You should avoid that at all costs. And in almost every case, you can avoid it. You can get yourself out of the hole that you've dug if you stop digging out the bottom of the hole, right? But if we keep digging out the bottom of the hole by taking on more debt and more loans and more payments, we're never going to get out of this hole.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Makes very much a lot of sense. So Brennan, I know you're against credit cards and loans, but can you tell us why you're against, like, I want to know the real answer on why you hate credit cards and loans.
Yes. The number one reason why I am so against debt, borrowing, credit cards, loans, just, you know, everything, it comes solely from the scriptures. As a Bible believer, I take it very seriously to follow them as instruction for my life. And there is no circumstance in the scriptures that borrowing is a positive. And I would actually almost argue the fact that we should not be borrowing. You know, we're duty bound as believers to not borrow. And so people will ask me, well, if it's biblical to not borrow, how come there's like the year of release in the law, for example, every 7 years you release the debt. The only circumstance that the Israelites were allowed to borrow according to the instructions of the Bible was from a brother or sister in the faith. And if you read carefully through all of that, you'll understand that that is because your brother or sister in the faith, if they lend something to you, they are not allowed to charge you interest. Whereas if someone outside of the faith is lending to you, obviously they can do whatever they want. And so we are not to borrow from those people. Well, everyone that we borrow from today is charging us interest. And so it's really, really wise to not borrow from anyone for any reason. And we don't. I mean, you just don't need to do it, especially in this country. You don't need to do it. We don't borrow for anything ever.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to skip the next question because, I mean, you kind of answered it. You know, the question was, what are the dangers and warnings of credit cards and loans? And obviously it's staying in a revolving door of debt.
Yes.
You know, you never get out of it if you keep borrowing.
That's right.
Now, I think I'm going to start charging my sister interest when she borrows money from me.
Just don't lend their money, man. That's another thing, man. The lending and borrowing, even though biblically we could make the case that you can do that with a brother or sister in the faith, it should not be done because it destroys relationships. I mean, if I sit down to have dinner with my brother and I owe him $2,000, that dinner is going to taste really bad.
Right? That's because
he's my master. My master. The borrower is the slave to the lender. It doesn't say unless it's a family member. It doesn't say unless it's a mortgage, unless it's a car, unless it's a credit card. No, you are a servant to whoever you're borrowing from. Do you want to be a servant? I know for sure I don't.
My sister and I, my sister's a year older than I. And I mean, look, we borrow money from each other most of the time. And she's really good about paying me back. Now, I don't think I ever borrowed money from her, but she's really good at paying me back on time when she says it. And for the longest time, she was never to that status of paying me back on time when she borrowed the money. Her and I sat down, looked at her finances, and, you know, I'm the blunt brother. So I'm like, look, sis, you got to get rid of the cable. You don't need it. I understand you got two boys that watch TV, but just have internet.
Yeah.
I will give you the password to my Netflix and Hulu if that would help you. And my sister in Texas, I did the same thing with her. I'm like, look, you are just building your career. Here's my Netflix password. Here is my Hulu password. Have at it.
Yeah. Well, see,
you know, I don't.
That's exactly it right there. You said kind of the underlying thing that I was talking about. When you borrow from someone, especially a relative or, you know, a friend or something like that, they're going to start to tell you what's going to go down in your life because they, you know, technically they have the right. They are your master in some sense because you owe them money. And so, let's say I owe my father-in-law $1,000 and I decide to take my family on vacation. How do you think that's going to go between me and my father-in-law?
He'll meet you outside with the boxing gloves.
Oh yeah. He's going to say, hey, what, you know, what's going on? You're not going on vacation. You need to give me my money before you go and do all these other things that you want to do. And it, again, so the, you know, payments and debt, they take away our options, and we don't want to be in that position. If you don't mind, we can spend just a little bit of time on some of the scriptures around debt and borrowing.
Oh yeah, please.
Okay. So, I will start with, most of them are going to be from the Proverbs. I'll start from Proverbs 6:1-8. So this is really good to pay attention to if you're in debt, and almost everyone listening to this is in debt. One of the questions I always get is how do you get out? How do you get the ball moving? How do you start this whole thing? Proverbs 6:1-8. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, have given your pledge for a stranger, that's Bible talk for taking on debt. If you are snared in the words of your mouth, caught in the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, and save yourself, for you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go quickly, plead urgently with your neighbor. Give your eyes no sleep and your eyelids no slumber. Save yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Go to the ant, O sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in the harvest. So what can we take from this? If we're in debt, this is the solution. Do this. Don't sleep. Don't give your eyes any rest. Work your butt off and get out of debt like the gazelle gets away from the hunter. How does the gazelle get away from the hunter? Let's say the hunter is the cheetah. It runs like its life depends on it, because its life actually depends on it. So our Father in heaven, who's infinitely wise, is speaking through Solomon, who he gifted with wisdom above every other man, to tell us, if you're in debt, you better get out of debt by working really hard and getting out of debt like your life depends on it. Look at the ant. The ant works really hard without anyone ruling over it, and it saves up its whatever it gathers for the harvest.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, because that's the whole point of this season, is that we want to bring biblical perspective into secular financial situations. Because if you think about it, the financial sector is secular. No questions about it. It is secular. Mm-hmm. And it's set up like that. Again, I said it earlier, modern day slavery.
Yes.
And then I'm not a racist guy here, but if you look at how the government functions, because I strongly think the credit is controlled by the government, and it is.
Oh, yeah.
It is another way to keep you in bondage to the government.
That's right.
Okay. And that is, again, I think that's why credit and stuff is not taught in school.
Yeah.
Is because they don't want nobody to know
about
it.
They don't want you to be free. They make money off of you. Everything's all good when you're not free. For them.
Yeah, it makes me want to homeschool my kids now.
Well, that and honestly, that's a big reason why we do homeschool. There's not enough life skills and things that are absolutely detrimental to humans, children growing up to be adults. There's not enough taught to them in the modern education system. So we've made the sacrifices necessary to do that ourselves. There's a couple more scriptures I want to go through just to really nail it home, this whole issue of debt and how the Bible views it and how the Bible believer should also view it.
All right.
So Proverbs 11:15, it says, whoever puts up security for a stranger will surely suffer harm, but he who hates striking hands in pledge is secure. So, you know, what's the reason to avoid debt, to avoid building your credit and taking on loans and all that stuff? Well, scripture point blank tells you whoever does it is going to suffer harm. Whoever doesn't do it is going to be secure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pretty simple.
I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, that bringing the biblical stuff into it is very important. And if you are not a believer and you don't believe in the Bible, please, please think about it. go look and reference the scripture. And I also want you to listen to what we said in this episode and go back and listen to the other two episodes, right? Because it has a lot of weight to it. You know, this is not something that we can teach you in one day. All right. This is why it's taken a couple of weeks to go through and talk about living financially balanced. Mm-hmm. I really should have named this season Living Biblically Financially Balanced, you know.
Yeah.
But
well, you know, like what you said, even if you're not a believer, my message is not solely for believers. It's definitely it appeals more to believers. But there is no question whatsoever that all of these proverbs regarding personal finance and all the rest of the scriptures outside of Proverbs regarding personal finance, there's no question that they're abundantly wise. And so even just people in the secular world who have no faith at all, they don't follow biblical instruction or anything, they still, a lot of them apply these types of principles to their finances. And because of that, they succeed. Success is a byproduct of following these biblical instructions. So it's really as simple as that. I'm not going to dictate what you do or what you believe or anything like that, but I'm certainly going to tell you that this is what I believe, this is why I believe it, and this is what I think that you should do. And I know for a fact, and I actually guarantee this for people who follow me and go through my coaching, I guarantee that it will work for them as long as they do what I'm telling them to do. There's no question in my mind whatsoever.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, look, just by listening and talking to you, Brendan, I've learned a lot. And I mean, how old are you?
I'm 26.
You're 26. I'm 31.
Yeah.
So I've already learned a lot from you, and I hate math.
Yeah.
But I love finances. Okay. And that's because finances is something that is part of my everyday life.
Yes.
Not algebra. Algebra right. has no bearing on my life. Right. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, and
it's all of us.
Yeah. If you're a math whiz and you say, oh, you use algebra every day, don't give me that BS. Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. I am a cop by trade. I work in law enforcement. I don't use algebra. If anything, I use geometry.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is why I wanted to do a season on finances, is because even when I am long gone from doing podcasting, which I wish that's never the case, I want this season to be ever true and ever, like, people can pull it up, listen to it, and start following these steps on what we're talking about, because it's something that we need to do and we need to learn as Christian believers and non-believers, mm-hmm. you know? So my last question, and this can be a simple one, because I know you're against credit cards and you don't like them, but although you don't like the plastic, can credit cards be used in a responsible way to help one financially?
I'm on the surface, I'm going to say no. And the reason okay. is all of these studies that the one that I referenced earlier, I mean, you guys can go and look it up for yourselves. These studies are out there. This is not, regardless of the level of responsibility that someone has, automatically they spend more money using plastic than they do if they're using cash. That's a simple fact, because of the way our brains work. When we don't have this interaction, when we don't see the money leaving our hand, then we tend to overspend. When you sit down and you look at, you know, you've got a purchase on the counter for $100 and you're about to hand over a $100 bill, you really run through the motions in your brain of, do I really want to spend this $100 bill on this item? Whereas if you've got something on the counter that's $100 and you're taking out the plastic, you're not running through that process, because you're not seeing the $100 go away from you. You're just spending it.
Right. So, I mean, look, I gotta buy new tires and I don't want to spend $300 on tires.
Yeah. Yeah.
and that's a necessity.
It is. And so, you know, and we come back, we keep going back all the way to the budgeting and the planning. There's a budgeting method that I talk about, using envelopes for purchases like what you're going to have to do with your tires. So all of us driving a car, we know that we're going to need tires in a few years, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years, whatever it is. If you divide your tires, let's say they're going to cost $300. If we're going to need tires in 2 years from now, we divide $300 by 24 months and we save that money by putting it into an envelope every month. That's going to be, you know, a few dollars a month that you're putting into an envelope that's labeled tires or car tires or whatever. So when the time comes that you need to purchase your tires for $300, instead of making a big $300 purchase in 1 month and that throwing off your whole budget, you've consistently saved little bits of money over time to make sure that you have the money to cover the expense of your tires. We all know that these things are going to happen in our lives. We need to start planning for them and being proactive instead of reactive. That's really the whole message.
Thank you for your time, Brennan, and your wise insight on finances. We look forward to speaking with you next week, and we look forward to learning more from you.
All right. Well, thanks for having me again, and we'll see you next time around.
This is Steve Selyartz, the author of The GA Junkie, and here are some Presbyterian history notes for the week of November 24th. Sunday, November 24th, in 1784, Elijah Slack was born. He was a pastor, but was mostly active in education. He served as a professor of natural science and the first vice president of the College of New Jersey. He left there to become the founding president of what would become the University of Cincinnati. He fell out of favor with the benefactor, and spent his remaining career teaching at secondary schools. Monday, November 25th, on this day in 1647, the Shorter Catechism was presented to the House of Commons, and the day after to the House of Lords, by the Westminster Assembly. The Commons accepted it, and the printing of it was ordered. Tuesday, November 26th, John Spottiswood died on this day in 1639. He was a complex individual, but an important figure in Scotland in his time. He was the son of a reformer and began his ministry and work as an ardent Presbyterian. As his career progressed, he tried to bring peace and unity by favoring the king and the king's demands for the episcopacy. Under the king, he was the Archbishop of St. Andrews and held several political positions. While he was against the new prayer book of 1638, with that and the National Covenant, he was forced to leave Scotland, and he died in London the next year. He served as the moderator of four general assemblies in 1610, 1616, 1617, and the last GA in 1618 before a long break. Wednesday, November 27th. In 1837, the Texas Presbytery of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church was constituted following the action of the Mississippi Synod the previous year. That authorized any three ministers to meet on Texas soil to constitute the presbytery. Three ministers met on the eastern edge of Texas. At that meeting, received a fourth as a candidate for ministry. Thursday, November 28th, Francis Allison died on this day in 1779. He was born in Ireland, trained in Scotland, and in the colonies became a noted Pennsylvania pastor. His synod complaint was a part of the old side, new side split, and he worked for a union and was called upon to preach the reunion sermon in 1758 on the topic peace and union, using Ephesians 4, verses 4 through 7 as his text. Friday, November 29th. On this day in 1775, John Rankin was licensed to preach by the Presbytery of Lewis. Earlier in the year, he had applied to the Presbytery of Newcastle, but objections were raised concerning his lack of a diploma. An overture was sent to the synod asking, quote, "May Presbyterians license persons to preach the gospel who have not obtained a degree from some college?" Unquote. The synod answered, quote, "As Presbyteries are the proper judges to determine concerning the literary and other requisite qualifications for the ministerial office, it is not intended to preclude any from admission to trial those who have not had the opportunity of obtaining public testimonials or degrees from public seminaries." Unquote. The way be clear, and Lewis being agreeable, he was examined and granted his license. Saturday, November 30th. This is the bicentennial of Auburn Theological Seminary breaking ground on their first building. This was largely a ceremonial event, and it was not until the spring that work began in earnest. Construction was regulated by available funds, and the building was ready for use in 1821 and fully completed in 1826. Thanks for joining me here on the EAR podcast, and I look forward to joining you again next week.
You have reached the end of yet another episode from The Ear. We hope that God's word remains on the ears of the listeners. We pray that this podcast would urge you to go forth and spread His good news to the world. Thank you for tuning in. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. See you at the next episode. God bless you, and may His glory shine upon you.